Today's date is July 28th, 1997. The speaker is Peter Cohen. The title is The Making of Meaning, Meaning in the Making.
For those of you who don't know me, my name is Peter Cohen, and I'm an architect in Seattle. I also teach architecture at the University of Washington. I came to architecture through a rather circuitous route. My original majors in college were art and philosophy. I've been coming to Holland Village for a long time. I worked in the pot shop for most of the summers in the 70s, and my wife Ann and I spent the year here, 79-80. And I finally wound up in architecture school, I think for a lot of the reasons that interested me in pottery. And now I teach and practice. When Nancy asked me to come up and be on the teaching staff, she left it wide open what I could talk about. And it took me a long time to figure out exactly what it was that I did want to talk about, because I teach architecture students. And I've never taught lay people about architecture before. So it was really good in a way, because it helped me try to get my thoughts in order. What I'm mostly going to do this week is show you buildings that I like. There is a theme, however, that ties them all together. Obviously, I like certain buildings for certain reasons. So that's what I'm going to try and explain at this first session. It may get a little bit heavy in this first session, although I hope not, but if you just bear with me, the rest of the sessions will largely be pretty pictures of architecture, so if you can just hang in there. The topic of my series of talks is the relationship between making and meaning, or as one architectural writer puts it, construction and construing. And the points that I'm going to try and make are that architecture is a cultural artifact that conveys meaning, it transmits values, whether we like it or not, and that architecture is a thing rather than a sign. Architecture can try to represent things, but first of all, it's just a thing itself. It's made of stuff, and that stuff has certain properties, and it has to be put together in a certain way, and it has to resist gravity. Sometimes we don't pay much attention to that anymore in modern architecture. And so from those two points, I'm going to make the statement that the act of making is an extremely important one. And it's in the making that we are able to convey values or meaning in the most fundamental way. To quote a famous architect that some of you may have heard of, Mies van der Rohe, "God is in the details." I think that actually is probably a good summary of the kinds of things I'd like to talk about and the kind of architecture I'd like to talk about. I thought a good way to begin as I was preparing this lecture would be to... I went around the house, actually, and picked up some everyday objects that I use every day and I think are particularly well made. And the first one that I came upon, I'll pass them around, although I'm sure you've seen these all before, was a spoon that sits in a pitcher among all of our other kitchen utensils that's made out of bamboo. It must be a fairly large diameter bamboo, but the bamboo, of course, is very stiff and very light. And this is a paddle that's been used, as I said, for years, and it shows the signs of that wear, but it still has hardly worn at all in terms of its lifetime of use. What I really like about it is that the handle itself, you can see the outside face of the bamboo, and you can kind of sight down the lines of it. You see it's a little bit shinier, and that the paddle surface has been cut out of the curvature of the bamboo, but it's cut down low enough so that it's able to get the width that's required. In order to do that, however, the back side of it actually records the inside surface, the inside round surface of that bamboo. And it's always been there, I've always noticed it, but it's kind of remarkable that this, the bamboo itself kind of registers its original form in the shape of this paddle. The reason I'm showing you these is because I want to make a comparison between these objects and what I consider to be well-made architecture. So I'm just going to pass these around. You can look at them and pass them on if you like. The other object is actually one that was recently acquired. And it's very different from the first object, although it is made out of a single material. The handles have been dipped in plastic so that it's easier to grip. But it's a pair of pruners. And I'd always wanted a good pair of pruners to prune the... We have a lot of, actually, Italian prune trees in our yard, and I've always used a big set of shears. And I always wanted a set of pruners, and I finally went out and bought a pair. Naturally, I bought the nicest pruners that you could buy. But the reason is that they were so well made. The handles are, they're all metal, different metal that's been formed in different ways, and so they begin to record the different ways that you can work with metal. The handles themselves and most of the tool are cast aluminum. But the blades are steel, because the steel obviously is much harder and holds an edge much longer. And so they've been riveted to the aluminum cast handles. And then you can see the evidence of actual grinding. After it was all riveted together, they continue to work the tool. They continue to grind it so that it would all work together. There wouldn't be any rough edges where the steel joins the aluminum. And finally, well, two other things. There are the machined parts that actually allow you to lock it shut when you need to and form the pivot point. And then there's a little piece of coil steel right here, which exploits another property of steel, and that is it really wants to return back to its original shape. So you can compress it, and it'll always come back to where it was before. And so, obviously, the benefits of that become evident very quickly. I'll pass this around. Be careful with it. There aren't any little kids in the room. So that's another well-made object that is very different from the first, in a way much more complex, but I think it shares that characteristic.
Would this have been handmade?
I suspect so. Yeah.
I would think it was the precision.
But there's hand making that occurs in that tool as well, I believe. The last thing I brought, because I'm a potter, I still pot sometimes, I'm doing some in the village this time as well, is a mug that I made in 1980, 17 years ago. And it's been sitting around my office. It's the one I use for coffee at my office, which is probably the reason that it hasn't broken by now. And I'm not going to say that this is a beautiful object, but I think it would be fair to say that it's a well-made object. I practiced pottery for a long time and produced thousands and thousands of mugs, and it's by virtue of that I think it was possible to make this object. The thing that I think is good about this object is that it's not the product of a lot of conscious thought on the part of the maker. It's the product of having done something so many times and understanding the property of materials that you do something almost automatically. It does a lot of things that record its making. First of all, if you look at the bottom when I pass it around, there's a little scalloped texture to the bottom of the pot. This pot is thrown off of a big lump of clay because when a potter sits down at a wheel, they want to produce many mugs at the same time. So rather than making a lot of small pieces of clay, the potter puts a big lump of clay on there and uses just the very top of it to throw the pot. And when I get done, I wrap a wire around the pot and slowly pull it out and cut the top pot off. The wire is actually twisted because it allows it to cut more cleanly. Sometimes when you use a nylon wire that isn't twisted, it tends to want to travel through the clay in unpredictable ways. And it's that twisted wire that actually produces this rather beautiful scallop shape on the bottom of the pot. The pot isn't trimmed at all. All that happens is you can almost see the joint of my finger, when I took the pot off the wheel, when it gets dry enough, in order to clean the bottom off, all that I do is just wrap the joint of my finger around the bottom of the pot. And you can actually see that. As a matter of fact, If you look very closely, you may be even able to see kind of the streaking of fingerprints, although I can't really see it that much on this one. The pot itself shows the way that it's made. If you know anything about pottery and thought about it for a while, you would be able to deduce that I'm a left-handed potter, because the ridges rise in the manner that a left-hander would throw the pots, because when you throw pots, the wheel wants to rotate the clay out of your hand, so a left-hander works on this side, where a right-hander works on this side. Those ridges are further accentuated when the pot is glazed. Glaze is very similar in composition to clay, so that it forms a very intimate bond with the clay, and so it's almost one thing. This particular glaze is one that changes radically in color depending upon whether it's thick or thin. This happens to have been an ash glaze, part of which was made out of ashes from the wood stove that was in the pot shop. And so you'll see that accentuates the ridges even more. It goes from yellow to brown and yellow to brown again. I determined very early on, or actually not very early on, but that it was really nice to make a little ridge right here in the pot, because from that ridge coming out tends to stiffen the pot right there, and that's where I would always attach the handle. And so you'll see, and it also allows this transition between coming straight up, or actually slightly in, creating this transitional point, and then being able to pull the lip out so that it's comfortable to drink from. Attaching the handle was equally straightforward and kind of the product of many iterations rather than a whole lot of deliberate thought. A small little plug of clay is dipped in water so the end of it gets wet, and it's attached to that ridge. And as I said, while the clay is still quite soft, I can push it onto that ridge and it'll still retain its shape because of just the structural nature of that ridge. And then the handle, more water is added to the handle and it's gradually pulled into its shape. And so you'll be able to see, I didn't smooth the handle into the clay there. You can actually see the remnants of the plug, the way that it was attached onto the mug. And then the way that's attached to the bottom is I made a little plaster stamp that had an HV on it, because I stamped all the pots Holden Village at that time. And so it's just stamped onto the pot. Once I calculated about how long it took me to make a mug like this, obviously it's a little bit difficult of a calculation, because it's made, then it has to dry a bit, then the bottom is smooth, the handle is applied, then it has to dry a bit. Then you have to fire it once so that you can apply glaze, and then glaze it and fire it again. But I finally came up with the estimate that it took about 6 minutes to make one of these. And that's kind of the beauty of it, that it isn't in the making of this object that a lot of time was spent. It's kind of the accumulated time of experience and really understanding a material well enough to be able to do it without thinking. And as I said, I think one of the main points I'm going to try and make about the architecture that I'm going to show today is it's so much about its making. And that's where a lot of sort of beauty in architecture can occur, is in the actual way that it's made. So let me pass that around.
Peter, that's a lot like a surgeon or something. It takes about 2 minutes to make the actual cut or do the procedure, but all the years of experience.
Right. Or a cook, you know, or anything like that, where you produce a product. I thought about trying to talk about or discuss what architecture is, and there was an architectural historian named Nicholas Pevsner that tried to define architecture by comparing a bicycle shed to a Gothic cathedral, and talking about one being a utilitarian building and the other being architecture. It's actually the wrong question, I think, and a lot of people have decided that it's the wrong question as well. I think maybe a more appropriate question is, what does architecture do, or what should architecture do? And so now I'm going to start the slides. If I could get somebody to turn the lights off on the wall right there. So these are two buildings or groups of buildings. These both happen to be from Scandinavia. I think this is Finland, and I think that's Sweden. But they're both buildings that were the product of a very long and continuous building tradition in a rather or less sophisticated culture. And these are called commonly vernacular buildings. And I think that in vernacular buildings, we still have the link to these everyday well-made objects. They're made with a limited number of materials. They're very clear about the way they're made. And they tend to be extraordinarily simple. The craftspeople that made these buildings didn't think about a new way of doing it every time they set out to make something. There was always a different circumstance. The ground was always slightly different. The orientation to the sun might have been slightly different. The soil might have been different. And so there were slight variations that had to be made. But the craftsperson that made these buildings really relied on this long building tradition that kept them from worrying too much about what it should look like. Okay, so what does architecture do? Buildings do certain things for better or for worse, intentionally or unintentionally. They are architecture to the extent that they do all these things well. Christian Norberg Schultz wrote a book called Intentions in Architecture, and he describes the building task. He says, the purpose of architecture is to give order to certain aspects of our environment. It participates in creating a milieu, that is, a meaningful frame for human activities. So I actually think that's a pretty good working definition. It creates a meaningful frame for human activities. He goes on to try and define some of these tasks in general categories, and he says that there are physical, functional, social, and cultural aspects of human activity. Then he talks about primitive architecture and vernacular architecture and how in early buildings all of those aspects were embodied in a single building. They were simple, and that's what they did. They embodied physical, functional, social, and cultural aspects. But as time has progressed, along with civilization, we've tended to break apart the building tasks. And so now they've become differentiated. And not all buildings do all of those things. Although there's kind of a level. First, buildings respond to physical forces. Then they try to be functional. Then they respond to social aspects of our world. And finally, they may reflect certain cultural values or meanings. I like to make the comparison, kind of a geological comparison. If you can imagine some land that was created over floods over time, and so sediment formed layers, and there are four layers, and then a glacier comes through and cuts them away. I think we're kind of at the bottom of that valley, and oftentimes we see peaks and plateaus that rise up one, two, or three levels, but on very few occasions anymore do we rise up and incorporate all four of those levels. So what I'd like to do first is just go through and briefly describe those four things. A tent is really a good example of a structure that tries to provide for our physical needs. When we're up in the mountains or on the snow or out in the woods, we're very exposed to nature. We're in an environment that we're not normally intended to be, and we wouldn't survive very long without some form of shelter. So that's what a tent does. Likewise, I think early buildings really are evidence of being primarily concerned with just protecting us from the elements. Obviously, therefore, they're highly influenced by the particular climate or environment that they're in and the materials that are available for building. And so these very simple structures, depending upon the level of enclosure required, the severity of the weather, what the elements are that need to be protected against, they'll vary quite radically in their form. After a building keeps us safe from the storms and the sun and the cold, buildings aspire to allow human activities to occur within. And so buildings start to take specific forms depending upon those activities. And so you can see a marketplace here. It helps for it to be a long linear building so people can set up their stalls and sell their wares, almost like an interior street protected from the weather. Yet at the same time, there needs to be a significant amount of light coming in. And so you can see this long shed with the high clerestories that allow these functions to occur. It's a very different shape of a building from a classroom. And on the other side, you can see a classroom. And again, natural light is very important. But the building probably wants to be more square or rectilinear in shape and have a different sense of orientation. This is a very specific building that forms a very specific function. It's the Uppsala Surgical Laboratory, is that what it's called?
Theater,
yeah, that's it. And so already from the outside, you can begin to sense that it's doing something different. It takes a fairly normal building form with a large gable roof, but out from that gable roof, this large dome appears with clerestory windows, and here's the inside of the dome. Well, the function is obvious. The whole focus of this room, this is my daughter Sonia, who's upstairs somewhere. She hasn't left yet. Having her diapers changed, I think, on the surgical table. But the function of this building is very important, and it takes on a very specific form in order to complete that function. Orientation to the outdoors, not just to provide light, but to understand the time of day and the seasons are also a very important function that buildings need to perform. Buildings are amazing reflectors of our society, particularly building forms that have developed over a long period of time. And when we look at dwellings in particular, and clusterings of dwellings, we can begin to surmise characteristics of that society based upon the way the buildings relate to one another. And so in Annapolis, Maryland, you have row houses that are very close to the street and they're all lined up together and all have their front stoops. And in China, everything is based around courtyards and the streets themselves are not very public. It's only a place for getting to and from one courtyard or the other. And you can see that on the upper right side of the frame, and then most of the activity occurs within courtyards that are largely centered around extended family units. I was thinking about Holden, actually, and the way that a lot of the built form at Holden reflects the fact that it was originally a mining community. And there are things that I think if this were built as a retreat center, wouldn't be done the way they are. The one best example, I think, is the Chalet Circle. The Chalet Circle was an indication of an extremely hierarchical society. And the mine bosses and executives all lived higher up on the hill, where they got more sun and better views, and were kind of above the area where the single miners lived and the store was and all of those other activities. I think, you know, that's one of the things that I think at Holden Village always has seemed a little bit strange, to have that hierarchy, and it's a result of the social aspects of a mining community are now influencing a completely different society that exists within those buildings. Here's another example, the Royal Crescent, which is a series of townhouses in England, and I believe this is Amsterdam somewhere. They're all places for living primarily, but again, they reflect a different relationship to work activities and social activities. Another aspect of performing social tasks is that in any society, certain buildings will take on more importance. This is in Charleston, and this is the public market, and the public market was the center of town. It was one of the most important areas of town, and it represented the way that society works. And so it ends up at the end of a main thoroughfare. So there is this Greek temple form at the end of the main street, and then behind it stretches the public market. So obviously this is a very important building in that society. Finally, we get to the cultural aspects that architecture tries to convey and house. When we think of that, we tend to think more often of things like town halls and churches. This is the Stockholm Town Hall. And I'm going to read a little bit of Norbert Schultz here. Architecture itself is a cultural object. It is a human product serving common human activities. Art, including architecture, expresses values, while science describes facts. Art is one of our means of communicating values to make them become common. In addition, only through cultural symbolization can architecture show that daily life has a meaning which transcends the immediate situation, that it forms a part of a cultural and historical continuity. And so these are the tasks that I think are probably the most difficult to perform and that have gotten separated from a lot of what we consider to be architecture today. This is Uppsala Cathedral.
What was that again?
Uppsala Cathedral. Very near the surgical theater, actually. Just down the street. Okay, one more thing I'd like to read about this notion of conveying cultural values. It actually comes from Heidegger. It comes from an essay entitled "The Origin of the Work of Art," and in it he's describing a Greek temple. But I didn't have a good example of a Greek temple in the situation that he described, so I found two buildings in the landscape because I think the points that he's making become clear in looking at these as well. A building, a Greek temple, portrays nothing. It simply stands there in the middle of the rock-cleft valley. The building encloses the figure of the god, and in this concealment lets it stand out in the holy precinct through the open portico. By means of the temple, the god is present in the temple. This presence of the god is in itself the extension and delimitation of the precinct as a holy precinct. The temple and its precinct, however, do not fade away into the indefinite. It is the temple work that first fits together and at the same time gathers around itself the unity of those paths and relations in which birth and death, disaster and blessing, victory and disgrace, endurance and decline acquire the shape of destiny for human being. He goes on to describe more of the physical characteristics of the temple. Standing there, the building rests on rocky ground. This resting of the work draws up out of the rock the mystery of that rock's clumsy yet spontaneous support. Standing there, the building holds its ground against the storm raging above it, so first makes the storm itself manifest in its violence. The lustering gleam of the stone, though itself apparently glowing only by the grace of the sun, yet first brings to light the light of the day, and breadth of the sky, and darkness of the night. The temple's firm towering makes visible the invisible space of air. The steadfastness of the work contrasts with the surge of the surf, and its own repose brings out the raging of the sea. To try and describe, I think, briefly what I think Heidegger is saying, I think there are two things. First of all, the first is about, again, buildings embodying cultural values. The second is about building establishing a relationship between humans and the world. The building stands there. It's a physical thing made of materials. It emerges from the rocky ground, and it brushes the sky. And so with that, let me get back towards the theme of what I want to present this week. Let me start by relating the roots of the word architect and architecture. Architect comes from the Greek, archi and tekton. It basically means master builder. It was originally tied closely to the craft of construction, which was in turn tied to a continuous cultural building tradition. Diversification of the building tasks, physical, functional, and social and cultural, along with specialization in the building trades, architect, contractor, subcontractor, product manufacturer, has led to a loss of purpose in architecture and a lack of understanding of the role of architecture in our culture. There's Holden Village in the summer and in the wintertime. One of the ways to regain that sense of purpose and an understanding of that purpose is to go back to the radical roots of architecture. It may mean discarding representational images of the past, but in order for it to do its tasks, buildings first have to be well made. I can't read my own writing. But in the making lies a potential to impart meaning. That the way a building meets the ground and sky, the way similar materials are put together, the way different materials meet, can form a poetics of construction that is more than the sum of its parts. In architecture, when we talk of buildings that convey a clear and powerful sense of their order of construction, we refer to their tectonic order. And again, tecton comes from carpenter, and it refers to a building that, again, has this very strong sense of the way it's assembled. There is a poetic connotation of the word tecton, too, that comes from Sappho. Sappho equated tecton, the carpenter, with the poet. And I like to think of this notion of tectonics as the poetry of construction. So we're going to look at buildings this week that, regardless of their function, perform all of the tasks that a building should perform. We'll look at buildings that are characterized by their strong power of their construction, their tectonic order. These buildings have the potential to recapture the qualities of their vernacular forebears. I thought of another quote that I wanted to use, and I could only recall it I'm not sure I'm recalling it correctly, but I'll paraphrase if it's not the right quote. It's also from Mies van der Rohe. He said, "Architecture is a language that has the discipline of a grammar. You can put two bricks together to make a sentence, or if you're really good, you can be a poet." I don't know whether the buildings that I'm going to show you are poetry, but I think they're buildings that at least attempt to look at the craft of construction and put them together carefully. So, in order to impress upon you the notion that this can happen in any building, not just churches or town halls, I'm going to start by showing you a restroom. Oh, sorry. This was where I wanted to be when I just gave that last spiel. This is a small chapel at the University of Otaniemi in Finland. It's a square. The bottom half is brick, the floor and the walls are brick, and the upper half is wood with wood trusses. It's got light that comes in from the back, and on the other side the wall is taken away and it's pure glass. The altar stands in front of the glass, and then you can see the cross stands behind the glass, and it sits among the trees out beyond the chapel. This is the kind of building that I'm talking about. It's extraordinarily simple. It doesn't refer to any previous architectural styles. It pays close attention to the power of materials and the way that they can be put together in order to create what I think is a very powerful and beautiful space. Now, restroom buildings. The reason I'm showing this first is because I know it the best. This building was designed by a Norwegian who was visiting going to school at the University of Washington and actually won a competition for a visitor center at Washington Pass, which is on the North Cascades Highway. After he won the competition, it was actually built, further designed through Kelbaugh Kelthorpe Architects, and Deb Kelbaugh also hired me on as a consultant to work on the project. So I was part of the building team. What I primarily worked on was developing a lot of the details and doing all of the construction supervision. It's up at the highest pass on the North Cascades Highway. And the attraction of that pass is that there is this absolutely fabulous view of Liberty Bell Mountain. And if any of you have ever seen a calendar from Washington State, almost every year has at least one month that shows Liberty Bell Mountain, usually with a mantle of snow on it. The building is made of primary materials and in a very honest way, so that we hope that you understand not only how the building is put together, but also the force of gravity, the 275 pounds per square foot snow load that's on this building in the winter when the highway is closed, and also the nature of the materials. The original proposal was to put two buildings along the path out to the overlook, where the most spectacular view of Liberty Bell Mountain is. The first building, the parking would lie in among the trees here by the first building. The first building is actually the rest stop. The second building is the visitor center, and you finally follow the path out for maybe another 100 yards and you get to the overlook. To the right is the visitor center that one day, when the Forest Service gets some more money, will be built. But at present, it's really nothing more than the parking and the restroom building and the path out to the overlook. The reason that that was funded is because at the end of one biennium, the Department of Transportation had some extra money. They could justify building the rest stop and the parking area, but it wasn't within their purview to design a visitor center, so they couldn't fund that. One of the characteristics of the buildings that I'm going to show you is their extraordinary simplicity, particularly in plan. Both the visitor center and the restroom building are simple rectangles. And you can see they actually are a little bit more complex in program than they would first appear, because this was intended to be a pilot project for the Forest Service, and they wanted to use composting toilets. But the crowd at this particular overlook at certain points of the year is large enough that composting toilets, if any of you know anything about them, couldn't handle the load. So we also had to use low flush toilets. And so actually what looked like two bathrooms are four. There are entries on the sides and there are entries on the middle. So there's a section of composting toilets and a section of low flush toilets. And depending upon the season and the volume of people coming in, they can be alternatively opened and closed. And so it got a little bit more complex than probably necessary. So there are some architectural plans depicting the inside of the bathrooms, the roof plan, and the basement plan, where all the big composting tanks are. The elevations really describe the idea of the building. There's a the plan does too. There's a large U-shaped stone wall that forms the back of the building. There's a smaller one that forms the edge of the platform in front of the building. And then some very large glue lamb beams rest on the back side of the wall, project forward, and then they're supported by columns, which reach up and touch them. Then the rest of the walls of the structure, the actual walls of the enclosure, are non-bearing. They don't really support any load. All the work is done by the rock wall, the concrete and rock wall, and the wooden structure. And so there's this ring of windows all around the top that allows light to come into the building.
What is that? I think if you back up, you can see it, and I think I may see it in this drawing, I'm not sure. Behind the building, that sort of looks like a ramp, kind of?
I'm going to show a lot of pictures. That's actually that's like an old storm door. That's the way you get down into the basement. Since it was only to be serviced by the Forest Service, they only needed a very utilitarian means of entry. So it's a big, we'll see it shortly. So as you drive up, it's about a mile off the road. You see a sign for Washington Pass Visitor Center, and you pull up, and the first thing that you see is the large concrete and stone wall. We don't build stone walls very much anymore, particularly in architecture, particularly for bearing, because they don't conform to a lot of the seismic regulations that we have for walls. So whenever you see a stone wall nowadays, it's usually clad. It's a layer that's added to a concrete wall. We wanted to use stone because it ties in so well with the setting. But at the same time, we didn't want it to look like a stone wall. And so you can see the concrete has pilasters where the lines of support come from the glue lamp beams that rest on the wall, and also the floor level, that horizontal line of concrete shows. If you look at the slide on the right, you can also see the extent of the building and the extent of the basement, and then where the wall continues outside the building, and so there's no longer that floor level with the building below. And there you can see the little bunker with the steel doors that are open and the vents for a lot of the equipment down in the basement.
Why didn't you want it to look like a stone wall?
Well, that...
aesthetics, I guess.
Well, it's not aesthetics. That really kind of gets down to the whole essence of these buildings, is that they really try to be honest about the way a building is held up.
So you didn't want it to appear like it was being held by a stone wall.
That's exactly it. You find ways to use the stone that actually acts as an infill material. So all of that, the beautiful qualities of the stone wall are there, yet at the same time, it talks about how the building is actually supported. You can also see on the roof, that's not a chimney. That's actually a vent stack. Composting toilets have to be vented. It looks like a chimney, but it's not. And then they try to power this mostly in the summer using photovoltaic cells. And that's what those are up on the roof. So here's wrapping around the building. You can see the corner of that building and how it meets the grade. I've included this construction shot so you can begin to see the layering of the roof. The roof is also laid up almost like a weaving of warp and weft to try and show how that heavy snow load again is conveyed down to the ground. And so, starting from the top, there's the metal roof, there's plywood, there's tongue and groove decking, and you'll see this all from the underside, but maybe I'll try and describe it with this picture here. And then there are 4x4 purlins that run the length of the roof, and you can see those sticking out right here. Below the 4x4 purlins are glue lamps that are approximately 8x8 that are staggered. I think you can start to see that here. So they only span one pair of beams, and then the next one is staggered back, the next one comes out, staggered back, comes out. And in a way, that's just a form of trying to show the transfer of this load, but also develop this wonderful kind of lattice-like roof that in some ways is light, but is carrying this very heavy load. And then finally, the glue lamp beams are paired so that the way they're connected both to the wall and to the columns in front can be through the center. And so you can see in this one right here, there's a big steel plate that comes up between the two of them, and then they're bolted to that steel plate, and then you can see the bolts, and then that steel connector sits on top of the concrete wall. As you come around the building, you can begin to understand the nature of its enclosure, both the inside and the outside space. It's basically those two C-shaped concrete and stone walls that form the precinct for this building. And within that precinct is this wood construction. You can start to see the windows up above that let the light in, and also these very strange looking columns. Wood columns in particular have this very strange property. Most materials that columns are made of are quite strong in this direction, in their length. The reason that most columns are thick is because they tend to buckle. Buckling occurs both in steel and in wood columns, so oftentimes columns are thicker than they need to be simply because they need to resist that buckling force that occurs in the center, and you can imagine that if you just think about it for a little while. These columns are tapered, so they actually show their minimum circumference at the bottom and the top that's required to carry the snow load, and they get larger toward wide enough to resist the buckling that's going to occur in the middle of their length. That's the reason for their shape. The reason that they're angled is simply to meet the glue lamps in a perpendicular way, but it also sets up this really wonderful contrast and difference between the primary structure, the beams and columns, and then the vertical walls that actually make the enclosure.
Are those solid?
They're glue lamps.
They're turned
glue lamps.
They're what?
They're a glue lamp beam, it's basically made up of a lot of little pieces of wood that's laminated together.
Oh.
These columns are originally glue laminated pieces of wood that are then turned. It was really interesting trying to figure out how to dimension these so that the metal connectors, the little kerf that comes down from the top and allows it to be connected to the beam, would fit perfectly. And you can imagine my extreme joy when I showed up the day that they had put them in, and it actually fit. The metal right here, you can see it, is flush with the wood. I was so relieved. So anyway, here you can see the effect of the roof and the way it kind of layers, and you can start to understand the transfer of load between those members, finally into the glue lam and down the beams and also to the back wall. The snow gets to be about 10 feet high here. Now, we've seen pictures of it. Somebody went in there with a big cat, and this large overhanging roof really does protect the front end of this building, better than we had suspected. Because all of the openings, we put these huge steel-clad doors that slide across them and protect the snow from coming into the building and pushing into that area, and also protecting the doors on the sides. It turns out, though, that when we saw winter pictures of the building, the snow piles up really high here and just came right down to the foot of these columns. So that wasn't entirely intentional, but we were really happy to see that.
How about the windows, Peter, drifting?
Well, there's enough overhang on the sides, too, that it really doesn't get up there. It never touches those windows.
It's not used during the winter, is it?
The North Cascades Highway is closed. It closes about, I don't know, sometimes it's open as late as December, but sometimes it usually closes around Thanksgiving. And it probably just opened. It probably didn't open much more than a month ago. So I think one of the interesting things is nobody ever really sees the snow on the roof. You kind of get it. You sense its presence by virtue of the structure of the building. So here it is again. The platform that's created is using slate that's native to the region, and it forms that platform, and then you can see the way the columns work. Another thing about columns that a lot of people don't understand is most columns don't resist lateral loads. There's another way that a building resists pushing forces, the pushing force of the wind or the pushing force of an earthquake. That's usually done with the solid walls. In this case, that pushing force is resisted by the big concrete and stone wall in the back. And so most columns really don't need anything more than a pin at the top and the bottom. That's actually allowed to rotate. And so in order to express that idea, we really did use funny little hinged connection that almost allows you to imagine that this thing really could rotate. Let me talk for a minute too about the wall. Here you can see you come around the side of the wall, and then again, you can actually see the wall's construction. It's almost as though it's chopped off. Rather than wrap the stone around the edge of the wall, we just build it right out to the edge, and you can see the real concrete wall that's doing the work on the inside.
Is the cap concrete too?
The cap is concrete too. There's a shot of the connectors. You can imagine the huge loads, and as you put loads on the roof, the roof wanting to start to twist one way or the other, and that's the reason for these large steel ears that connect it more firmly, the glue lamp more firmly to the roof, and start to resist that sort of sideways force.
Do you have a way to calculate whether it's going to hold or not? Or
well, we hope that our structural engineer did, and it's lasted 3 winters now of some pretty severe snowfalls. The one thing that we didn't anticipate, the structure itself lasted well. One of the things that we didn't anticipate is that the roof is a standing seam metal roof, and the weight of the snow actually bent over all of the standing seams, but not in one direction. It was almost as though the snow piled up on the roof around that stack and started to twist. It almost acted like a glacier. So some of the seams are bent this way and some of the seams are bent that way. It's just the most amazing thing that we've ever seen.
Are all those metal parts custom made, Peter?
They're all custom made and they're galvanized. So they're steel that's then galvanized. And here you can see fairly nicely that whole layering of the roof again and the way the windows meet it. The doors to the actual restrooms, which I think we're going to go inside pretty soon, although they're pretty much restrooms. A little bit, you know, that carries to the cladding as well. And so one of the things that we wanted to do was to really emphasize the horizontal of the cladding, because when you start putting a lot of vertical elements, particularly at the corners, it starts to look like structure. And we really wanted to look like almost a laying up of a wall that stops short of the roof. And so we went for a horizontal cladding, alternating bands of narrow and wide, and with exposed fasteners. The exposed fasteners actually were originally going to be Phillips head screws. They're pan head screws, if you know what that is. But we realized that a lot of snowmobilers actually make it up to this building in the wintertime and figured that they might have a Phillips screwdriver in their tool chest. So there's a square head driver that we use that's not nearly as common, and we haven't lost any siding yet. As any of you who have built anything know, there are several ways to make a corner with siding. The most common way is just to put corner boards up, vertical boards into which to butt the siding. That has the problem of discontinuing these horizontal lines as they wrap around the corner, so we wanted to find another way of doing it. The most common way of doing that is to miter the corners, give each one a 45 degree angle and just butt them together. Wood doesn't shrink much along its length, but it does shrink a little bit. So what often happens with minor corners is they start to separate. So what we, after much agonizing, what we decided to do was almost a log cabin corner. We alternated the layers and lapped them over one another. We had to cut off the tongue from here to here, or in this case, from here to here, so that one could slide in on the other. We had to seal the ends really well. One of the things that made us feel like we could do it was how well protected the corners were by the overhangs of the building, and that has actually been borne out by seeing pictures of the snow, because that obviously will allow weather to get in there if you're not careful. But we decided that it wouldn't weather too badly, and that this would really kind of also be another way of showing that siding by actually looking at the end of it at the corners. It's cedar. And so here's the that corner of the building where you go into the side restrooms. You can see that the stone wraps behind, but then it stops and the concrete wall is exposed, and that concrete wall travels into the building. Here, one of those smaller steel clad doors that slides over the door, the regular door in the wintertime. The bathrooms are treated in a similar fashion. Obviously, in a place like this, you have to really be concerned about vandalism. And so everything had to be steel. And even the mirrors are steel. But we wanted to make a distinction between the steel of the walls and the steel of the fixtures. So while most fixtures come in what's called a number 4 finish, which is what we all know as brushed aluminum, We had the steel-clad plywood panels on the walls done with a number 2 finish, and you can see it's a slightly frostier finish. So you can begin to make a distinction between the wall panels and the fixtures themselves. And again, they're screwed in a similar fashion to the siding outside. Here you can get a really strong sense of the motion of those walls really stopping short of the roof, and then the roof being all windows and letting the light come in. These were taken before the steel, the panels were cleaned, and so there are all kinds of smudges and marks, but those went away. Anytime you're putting plywood panels together in this way, you have to worry about them expanding and contracting, so that you can see there's a little bit of space between the panels that allows that to occur, a little bit of gasket and sealant in there. So that's an example of the kind of work that I'm going to show you this week. I will be focusing upon places of worship because, well, one reason is because that's what a lot of you are interested in, but the main reason is actually that that's where oftentimes an architect has the opportunity to really spend more time and care in the crafting of a piece of architecture. So with that, are there any questions about this?
Why is it that?
That's because that's the one place where people really understand that architecture wants to happen. That one of the points that I'm trying to convey is that architecture is a creative act. I've actually been thinking about this some time. There's going to be a forum on Holden Village and the nature of a lot of the architectural projects that have occurred here over the 20 years, and what I think is kind of a laissez-faire attitude towards buildings. And as we are reflections of God, our creations are all reflections of us. And just like a finely crafted pot, I think every time that we do something, every time that we perform surgery, or we make a meal, or we build a building, that we should think very carefully about what we're doing and do it well. So, in spite of the fact that I am going to be showing you mostly churches, I'm also going to show you a warehouse and a truck garage to impress that fact upon you further. So the next lecture will be called Building with Sticks, and we'll look at some wooden architecture, and then Building with Stones, and we'll look at some masonry architecture. And then finally, the last lecture is a little bit different.
Yeah. You had mentioned at one point that I'm not at all anywhere near an architect student, but the point that these elements were happening without regard to function. And it somewhere along the line, that old adage about form should reflect function. And it sounds like you're sort of saying these are good buildings because they're so simple, it doesn't even matter what their function is.
Yeah, that's not something that I necessarily mean to convey. I think all of these are very functional buildings, too. I don't think that that's the problem of modern architecture, that it's trying too hard to allow certain functions to occur within it. I think that actually it's a fairly simple task to create architecture that allows functions to occur within them.
But should the form tell you something about the function?
I think it should.
Okay.
But I think the details should as well.
Okay.
Any other questions about this building or about anything that I said? Go ahead.
This is what you said, but I'll say where I'm coming from. Maybe you've gotten to Rochester, Minnesota.
No, I've never been there.
Well, you ought to come. The mayor of Clay has had enough money to have architects who have been, and some of them, they have some huge waste of spaces that are gorgeous. And somebody told me, yeah, that's the architect's signature and privilege. Is that a modern phenomenon?
That's an unfortunate modern phenomenon.
So it's sort of true?
What did she say? I mean,
I think it's an unfortunate... She talked about the Mayo Clinic and there being some buildings there with some very large, relatively wasted spaces that have been ascribed to being the signature of the architect.
And the gorgeous.
Yeah, and she asked if that was a modern phenomenon.
But it has nothing to do with a medical clinic.
Right, right. But does it have anything to do with the whole... I guess I would ask this, not knowing anything about it. Does it have anything to do with the whole nature of healing, both kind of spiritually and physically? Are these spaces of repose for people to actually sort of gather their thoughts or, you know... I don't know, as I said, because I don't know the examples that you're referring to. But the worst thing is that it'd be a signature of the architect. You know, going back to the example of the pot that I made, one of the reasons that I like it is because I think I got out of it. You know, I think that I didn't really leave an individual signature, that it was really kind of almost an unconscious act that was based upon the way clay is made and kind of techniques that I learned to use it. And that's really what I think about this architecture. I would hope that it isn't signature architecture. One of the things about the buildings that I'm going to show you, I'm not going to show you multiple works by a single architect, but many of the architects' work that I'm going to show you, you will have heard of none of them, because they tend to work in their milieu without a lot of fanfare. But also, when you look at more than one of their buildings, they're very different, because they respond very differently to a different site, a different program, different social activities, and also the different materials of which they're built. So the signature architect is something that I think is bad for the profession.
And it seems, I mean, how does it happen? Because I know Portland's another example where here's a Michael Graves building that got a lot of fanfare and is heralded as this wonderful thing. And now people don't even want to work in it because it's so oppressive horrible.
Right.
And you know, all this money and all these design review boards are saying, this is wonderful. I mean, is this because we just don't have good people with good eyes? Or?
There's a lot of politics involved. There's a lot of lack of understanding that's involved. I don't know, if you're from Portland, you probably know much of the story. There's this long story about that building and that how Michael Graves' mentor, Philip Johnson, was on the selection committee. And that's largely the reason that project was selected from among the others. And it's a sad state, actually. I think I'm not at all pleased with the state of architecture today. I look at most buildings and I think most buildings designed by architects, and it makes me rather sad because I think that a lot of architects don't really understand what their task is. And that there's nothing, that the only thing that I can do about that is to try and teach people what I think the tasks are, and to try and point out buildings that I think do them well. Well, it's 10 to 5, so...
Yeah, one question.
Yeah.
What building?
It's not a well thought out question. I don't have a good feeling for what I'm exactly saying. It seems like there may have been a lot more cost involved in having this project that you've shown us be developed. And
just a bathroom, after all.
Yeah, this is an expensive building, particularly for a bathroom.
Sure.
The only reason it was built this way is because it's part of a visitor center. And some of the projects that I'll show you probably cost more than an average building.
So form, function, cost.
Well, but my contention would be that cost can be factored in. There are still ways to make good buildings carefully, you know, given costs. But in this case, as I said, it was part of a larger project. This is the thing that strikes me so much about this building now, is that it does seem almost obscene for a restroom, because that's all that's there now. If you understood it connected to the visitor center, it would all of a sudden seem okay. It's a building that's intended to exist in very harsh climate for a very long time. And I think it's not overkill, but on the other hand, as I said, it really, at its present state, seems a little bit out of context.
Well, the interesting thing that we saw on our trip to Europe last year was being in Switzerland and being in the area around Interlaken and having one type of architecture. And then we took a train and we went through a mountain tunnel. We came on the Italian side and suddenly everything was snow, and it was just totally changed. Some change in climate, but a lot of it was just what was available and cultural. Traditional.
Well, it may have been materials too. It may have been
materials. Certainly affected. Yeah. You know, it was just a real interesting thing to see a change just going through a tunnel.
Yeah, I know. That's absolutely. That is really fascinating.
Why the grass on top of the roofs? Is that
here
as well?
The old buildings. Well, I think that was a good way of insulating, actually, and keeping the roof down. Oftentimes, you'll see old Swedish buildings that have long strips of birch bark laid out and then they'll have logs across them at the top and the bottom, and then big stones holding the logs down just to keep something on the roof. I think that actually having a sod roof was a very practical way of keeping the roof down. Well, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.